Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, we meet inventors and pioneers who have changed the way we eat. We begin with Louisiana's spiciest new business, Louisiana Pepper Exchange. Founder and CEO Chris White shares the story of the amazing engineering feat he had to accomplish before his unique product could be possible. Next, we learn about the invention of the sugar snap pea and its father, Dr. Calvin Lamborn. Rod Lamborn joins us to discuss his late father's delicious legacy. Finally, we hear the fascinating story of Leon Gottschall. Peter Wolfe tells us how an illiterate Jewish immigrant built a 19th century New Orleans business empire, largely due to post-Civil War Louisiana sugar production and his innovative spirit. We're getting to know some of the delicious fathers of food invention on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Chris White, founder and CEO of Louisiana Pepper Exchange.
You might call Louisiana native Chris White an overachiever. After all, he graduated from West Point with an engineering degree, served honorably in the Army, and after completing his service, quickly became an indispensable member of his father's firm, Chemitech. Early on, Chris was tasked with solving a major problem for the global hot sauce industry, specifically the transport of pepper mash. Pepper mash is exactly what it sounds like, an assortment of chili peppers that are mashed together with salt and aged until they break down chemically.
Pepper mash is a very difficult product to handle because it's got a high solids content and it's a fermenting product. So it's actively fermenting through the entire life cycle of the pepper mash to include when it's in transit.
When Chris joined Chemitech, pepper mash was shipped using flexi tanks, a bladder that fit into a container for transporting large quantities of liquid. While in transit, the mash would continue to ferment, so solids and liquids would separate from each other. This made it very difficult to pump out the pepper mash once the flexi tanks reached their destination.
The problem with a flexi tank is there was no way to be able to mix the pepper mash back to a homogeneous state once it did separate in transit.
To solve this problem, Chris engineered the AgiTank. This technology uses a series of injection points on the top of the bladder to mix the mash up again, allowing it to flow freely at the unloading point. His invention led to a whole new business opportunity, the Louisiana Pepper Exchange. We met Chris at his warehouse on Felicity and Chapultepec to get the full story of this very spicy company.
Everything we have done since I've been at Chemitech, because we were always problem solvers, has developed out of helping someone solve a problem. So when we did this AgiTank system to ship pepper mash, we were trying to solve a problem for a customer. It was really done to help them out with no real ambition of turning it into a business. Once we were able to solve the problem, refine it, make it commercially viable, then became obvious that we could do something with it. We could start shipping with it. We could start generating revenue by producing the product. We could solve other people's problems. So really, it's just all born out of problem solving, and everything has evolved from there.
Now, originally, if I understand it, Louisiana Pepper Exchange wasn't a retail business. Let's talk about the role you've played and still continue to play as a packer and a maker for other big companies.
Yeah, so really it started, it's a really funny story. When we first started shipping, we weren't really buying the pepper mash. We weren't contracting the peppers to be grown. We were selling packaging and doing shipping. So we did that in 2004. We started that. We were shipping large volumes of pepper mash. And I don't know if you remember, but around 2009, 2010, hot sauce really started taking off. And not just your traditional hot sauce. People were demanding spicier hot sauces, something fun and innovative. So people started actually calling us and saying, hey, we hear you ship lots of pepper. Can we buy some from you? These were smaller hot sauce guys. We'd like to do pepper mash in bulk. And I said, sure, I think we can do that. We can send you 52,000 pounds in our Agi tank. And they would look at me or be on the phone. They'd go silent. And they'd say, oh my gosh, I need like 80 pounds, right? So they were either growing it locally or getting it from a farmer's market or sourcing it somewhere not very reliably. So it dawned on us that we could solve another problem, okay? We could start taking our system, contracting growers and farmers to produce a pepper mash for us, bring it here very cost effectively with our own intellectual property, unload it in our own facility, store it in bulk, and then repack it as an ingredient for hot sauce makers, any other people that are using pepper as an ingredient in their food production. So we started selling industrial pepper ingredients, and that's how we started.
Now, the range of peppers that you deal with and that you have the ability to deal with is enormous.
That's correct. So it's, you know, we started shipping mostly peppers that are used in high volumes for traditional types of hot sauces. So that would be cayenne, some jalapenos, some habaneros. And as that industry, that craft and gourmet hot sauce industry, which we provide a large percentage of the pepper mash for, started evolving and demanding more creative and more spicy peppers, we started then having these growers, we contracted these growers to grow many different varieties of peppers. Fortunately for us, our intellectual property, our packaging system, is most effective when used in a sea container coming from overseas. So, and we had relationships with growers in South and Central America, so we started contracting them to make all kinds of different peppers that people were demanding. So traditionally, those guys were just growing other things. So we introduced them to an understanding of the U.S. market, and they started growing peppers for us. So, you know, we go anything from a jalapeno and a cayenne to a Scotch bonnet to a serrano to some of the super hot stuff like ghost pepper and reaper and scorpion, Aji Amarillo, which is a pepper that's really on trend right now.
When Louisiana Pepper Exchange started in 2010, it was based out of Baton Rouge. But as the company grew, they found the Crescent City to be a much better fit. After the historic 2016 flood in Baton Rouge put the company underwater, they found a home just a stone's throw from the port of New Orleans. When containers with pepper mash are offloaded from ships, their trucks travel only a few hundred yards to reach the warehouse.
Having that location is another reason that we're so efficient with our supply chain, that we can bring pepper mash in so cost effectively. So being here is extremely important to our business.
Chris, let's talk about how other consumers are using your purees, because this truly is a unique product and nothing like it has ever existed on the market before. Explain through an end user's point of view why this is so special.
It's really unique because it is an all-natural product that's an ingredient. So it's not a sauce, it's an ingredient. We're taking a natural product, a pepper, we're going through a natural preservation process. And we are now providing the consumer the closest thing they could get to a fresh pepper. Because as you know, peppers have a very short shelf life. So if you buy a fresh pepper, they don't last very long. There's a lot of spoilage, a lot of waste. When you de-stem and de-seed a pepper, a lot of that pepper gets thrown away. This product is shelf stable. It's very efficient. It can be used to spice up any recipe that you would ever make. Additionally, because we have all these different types of peppers that we do, some of the peppers that we offer are not traditionally available in a fresh form. So you would not be able to go to the grocery store and get a red habanero or a ghost pepper. We do chipotle, which is a whole different twist on the chipotle presentation, but there's more to come because, you know, we're working on some other varieties of peppers right now that we hope to be launching that will allow people to experience cuisines from different parts of the world that maybe they wouldn't have access to normally.
One of the reasons your story is so interesting to me is because when we're talking about food production, in my mind at least, you've sort of gone the opposite direction that many people usually go in. What made you decide to go after that end-use retail customer when so many people are already getting your product just in another form?
I think it was a vision we had many years ago. We just didn't really know how to execute it. We grew up really in the industrial space, and the evolution really kind of goes back to solving problems, as we talked about before. So like restaurants is where we started. You know, we solved the problem for them by creating a cost-effective ingredient. And once we saw some success with that, it became obvious to us that probably the consumer at home would like to do the same thing. So we thought that we had a natural, perfect solution for people to do that at home.
Well, bravo. You are just Louisiana's newest pepper ambassador. And I am so tickled to be able to sit down with you and introduce you to our Louisiana Eats audience. Thank you, Chris.
Well, thank you. We're honored for you to be here.
That was Chris White, founder and CEO of Louisiana Pepper Exchange. Coming up next, we learn about the legacy of Dr. Calvin Lamborn, father of the sugar snap pea. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Crystal Hot Sauce, always made with just three simple ingredients: aged red cayenne peppers, distilled white vinegar, and salt. Nothing artificial. Crystal Hot Sauce. Step out of the heat and into the flavor. From Rouse's Markets, synonymous with seafood, straight from Louisiana's waterways. Rouse's Markets tastes like home. And from Camellia Brand, beans done right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923. Camellia's latest innovation makes life easy for today's smaller households. Beans for two. If a bag of beans is too big for your family, Camellia's New Orleans-style red beans for two and Cajun-style white beans for two has everything needed for dinner in today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. Whether they're cooked up in a stir fry or eaten raw as a snack, it's estimated that more than 150 million sugar snap peas are consumed around the world each year. This pervading variety of pea is actually a relatively new vegetable, created by accident by Dr. Calvin Lamborn in 1979. Known as the father of the snap pea, Dr. Lamborn spent his life perfecting this and other pea varieties, revolutionizing the industry in the process. Sadly, Dr. Lamborn passed away in August 2017. But we had the opportunity to talk with his son, Rod Lamborn, a cinematographer based in New York City who's working to maintain his father's pea legacy. I first asked Rod to explain how and why peas became Dr. Lamborn's whole life.
Well, my father started back in 1969. He was given a direction to fix the distortion on the snow pea and what they came up with the snap pea by crossing a rogue shell pea with a snow pea. And it wasn't without its problems either. There was, some internal struggle with this new class of pea. There were people in the company that didn't think there was any value with that. They tried to shut the program down multiple times. People had a hard time understanding that you could eat the pod. And I have a really distinct memory of being about 7 years old in Twin Falls, Idaho, and telling my next door neighbors that I was eating peas so that you could eat the whole pod, and them telling me, like, no, you really can't do that. And being surprised, because, as a kid, you don't tell an adult, like, I think you're wrong. Yeah. I can do that. But I remember my father saying that he had something there that was really special. And he persisted. When people tried to shut him down, I think he just doubled his efforts. It took at least two generations to notice that the snap pea came out of this. And then an additional few years for there to become any kind of recognition. It wasn't until 1979 that the snap pea won an All-American Selection Gold Award for introducing a new vegetable.
That's something that doesn't happen every day.
No, the gold award that he won is very rare. It's an extremely prestigious honor. And it took that for the snap pea to really start getting traction.
He was really a visionary in so many ways. And after he has the original snap pea, he goes on to figure out how to make them grow in all sorts of astonishing colors and such. Tell us about where he went from the original green snap pea.
He was working for a company when he developed the original sugar snap pea, and they retired him early. So he was about 63 years old, and they said, oh, guess what? We're going to let you go. And he didn't like that. He said, I'm not done. I want to keep going. And when he retired, he actually worked harder than he ever had in his whole entire life, because he no longer had his laboratory, his research assistants, his lab techs. He had him, his notepad in his mind, and he was able to continue with what it was that he was doing, charting out plans of what to do for the future, and do it without a corporate entity telling him, you can't do that. He was able to do things that increased pod productivity, that made it so the plants were more vigorous, produced more pods, could handle some of the pressures of insects and environment, and still excel. So his passion for peas actually accelerated, and his ability to do crosses and bring to market shortened. They say it usually takes 10 years from first cross to introduction to market. 4 years, 6 years became our model. So we have this germplasm that's just fantastic. And we have all these different traits that we've been able to figure out the plants that have, they express the best part of these traits. And when you start taking all these different traits from peas that have never been crossed before, then you start getting things that you didn't expect. Like the maroon snap pea, the maroon snow pea. Like that's a color that didn't exist earlier, but it's a color that works within the boundaries of the genetics of the snap pea and snow pea. And every color has a different flavor. When I'm talking to chefs in the farmer's market, if they like the purple, then I understand that they really get what's going on with food. They know how to take that purple and make it work for them.
Do you have any stories about relationships between your dad and chefs that grew up over time?
You know, my father had somewhat of a relationship with the late James Beard and had met and spoken with him and corresponded with him. But these current things that have been happening has been more my doing, where I've been meeting with chefs and introducing new varieties to them. And, you know, I learned pretty quickly in New York that I could, and I had done this. I went into Alain Ducasse and I said, my father developed the sugar snap pea. I'd love to meet the chef. A couple weeks later, I'm in meeting the chef, which is kind of a strange thing to do. It's kind of like a little kid, you know, coming in, you know, it's like I fell off the potato truck and here I am in New York, like knocking on your door and saying like, yeah, my daddy did this. Can I come and talk to you? And I didn't know how to approach this restaurant, this most special restaurant that I'd ever been in before this time was Sizzler. And so I'm going in with a suit and tie. I bring in the peas. I walk back into the kitchen. The whole kitchen stops with food prep and everybody gathers around. And I'm able to present the peas, the new stuff that we have. And the chef took a bite and he said, how much do you got and how soon can I get it?
Oh, what a great reward. Your dad must have been so proud of you. What did he have to say about these bold marketing efforts for someone who perhaps had a Sizzler palate previously?
Well, he wanted all the grandkids to go out and start doing this all around the nation. So I was like, no, slow down. It works. But it's an awkward situation to be in. And I got better at time talking to chefs and understanding what to do. I have a great relationship with Rick Bishop, who is a very esteemed culinary grower that supplies the best chefs in New York City. And this really opened up many of the other restaurants, many of the other chefs. So my father developed a leafy green that took an academic curiosity and he turned it into something commercial. And Rick grew it out. The very first day he brought it to the farmer's market, Thomas Keller pounced on it. When he saw these peas, he took them back to his kitchen. And his chef de cuisine, David Breeden, decided to take them and to trim off the tiny little leaflets to garnish a soup bowl. And so you'd get these little tiny little specks of green, and you would eat them, and it had a nice flavor of fresh peas. But it's a leaf that's so small. How did that get that flavor in there? That was the first presentation of the Lamborn snap greens. And interestingly enough, my father was so happy about that story. We were invited out to French Laundry to meet their team, the front of house and back of house. And we were at a barbecue. And my dad was telling that story to David Breeden. And I said, Dad, stop. Like, this is the guy that actually came up with that technique. Because he was trying to tell him, like, oh, and then per se did this. And they put it together like this. And I said, Dad, stop. This is the guy that actually came up with that idea. And he stopped mid-sentence. And he said, oh, thank you. And it was such a remarkable moment to be able to have that full circle. Because here we are, you know, with French Laundry.
Yeah.
Mind you, the fanciest restaurant that I'd ever been in when I was growing up is Sizzler. And we're at the top, the best that you could possibly be. And here's my dad and the chef sitting down, having a great conversation, talking about life, the history of the peas, and kind of the evolution of the peas.
What an inspiration. Even though he got forcibly retired in his early 60s, he really didn't stop.
Well, I'll start with this. My last conversation with my father was about peas, and it was a very peaceful conversation because I understood that that was my last conversation with him. And I was really happy to tell him that we've got it covered. We've got things taken care of here. And we just had a moment of silence. But so I'm honored to say that it was so important to him that that was our world. I've been with my dad for the last 15 years at some degree, and now it's the burden rests on me. And let's just say that there are sleepless nights where I try to figure out, like, well, what am I going to do and how I'm going to do it? You know, and I've told people this before. It's like there's a lot of me running around like my hair's on fire. Like there's so much stuff that I have to figure out. And the sad points for me are when I want to call my dad and tell him, oh, guess what I figured out? Go, guess what happened? Guess what we were able to do here? And, you know, I can't. Like, those are the more somber moments where it's like he'd be so proud if he knew that we were able to, like, do this or manage that. Because he was very appreciative of the work that people did for him.
Rod Lamborn, New York-based cinematographer and son of the father of the sugar snap pea, Dr. Calvin Lamborn.
I'm Peter Wolf. I'm the author of The Sugar King, Leon Gacho, a New Orleans legend, his Creole slave, and his Jewish roots.
How does a poor, illiterate Jewish immigrant build a New Orleans business empire in the 19th century? The Sugar King tells the remarkable story of Leon Gacho, who went from peddler to clothing baron, railroad builder, and titan of the sugar industry. Peter Wolf is not just the author of the book, he's also the great-great-grandson of the Sugar King himself, Leon Gacho. Peter joined us in the studio to discuss what he uncovered while researching this largely forgotten figure in Louisiana history. Your great-great-grandfather, it just seems incredible today that he came alone from Alsace-Lorraine at 13 years old. Tell us a little bit about his arrival in New Orleans in 1837.
Well, I couldn't believe it myself when I first heard about his life and his arrival. I went to his village in Ebreviller in France, in Lorraine, to try to understand a little more about where he came from. And it was an impoverished place, very small village, mostly agricultural all around it. And there was no opportunity there for him because he started working as a peddler when he was about 7 or 8 years old to help support his family. So out of desperation, really, he got on a ship all by himself. First, he had to travel to Paris, and then from Paris to the port of Le Havre and get on the Indus, the ship he was on. And for 4 months, he was at sea, below decks, obviously. And he lands in New Orleans. He comes here because he can speak French, but he's illiterate. He can't read or write. He's never been to school. And he starts his life right here at the foot of Canal Street.
There was a family friend here, a Leopold Jonas.
Yes, there was a man that they somehow knew something about, and I think a letter was sent to Jonas in advance mentioning that this child was going to show up in New Orleans, and Jonas harbored him for a while.
Describe for us how he started to make his way in life here.
Well, I think Mr. Jonas sort of staked him to a backpack full of stuff and told him to get out of town and start working out of the city because the yellow fever was terrible. And this child had no immunization at all and no immunity, had never been around the kind of problems we had here, and gave him an idea to go up the river road and do what he could. And the little kid walked out of town with a pack on his back and ends up being a very celebrated titan.
He would ask permission and be gained admission to the slave quarters and sell to the slaves as well as the plantation owners.
He did. I think he had an affinity for underprivileged and mistreated people because his family had been that, and made sure that he was helpful when he could be, and fair and humble.
So once he gathers enough capital from his backpack peddling and has his first little general store in Convent, then he begins that Gacho clothing store business in New Orleans on Decatur Street. But it was originally just limited to men and boys' clothes. Huh?
Yes, for years, for many years, it was men and boys. And, of course, he chose Decatur Street in a canny way because it was right at the port. The port was the third largest port in the country. The city was the third largest city in the country when he came here.
He did a lot of things right, and certainly one of those things was finding your great-great-grandmother, Justine, because she could read and write also.
She was highly educated. Her parents were teachers and also immigrants from Lorraine. So you can imagine the magic of these two meeting in this foreign land from similar backgrounds, or similar towns anyway. She was much more educated.
He was so clever to get he and his family out of the fray of the Civil War, but also certainly his money.
Right. He was very prescient about that. I think it's partly that he was a foreigner. He wasn't invested in the South and the old Southern myth, and he saw what was coming. He got his family out of New Orleans just before the war began. He actually rented a big place in New York and started a business there because he had no idea how long he might be away and if he would ever come back.
But he retained his businesses in New Orleans. They were still here.
His brother ran the business in New Orleans, and they were back and forth to one another with cables and things like that. And in New York, Leon Gotcho recognized that manufacturing of clothing was going on, and the sewing machine was an object he had never seen or heard of. There was no manufacturing of clothing in New Orleans at the time. So learning all the time. And he ultimately, of course, brings a sewing machine back to New Orleans and begins to manufacture, the first to manufacture clothing here. It liberated clothing, manufactured clothing for people who couldn't afford decent clothing before.
Well, let's talk about that vital plantation, that first plantation in Reserve, Louisiana, because it wasn't an act of estate building. It was really an act of kindness that he felt he owed this widow.
Exactly. He had been ill at Reserve at one point, and the mistress of the plantation took care of him, let him rest at the place. And many years later, Sophie Bodescue was her name, came to him, this was during the Civil War, and said she was having great difficulty making ends meet. Of course, there was labor problems, and there was problems with distributing sugar and so forth and so on. The economy, the agricultural economy, was a disaster. And he said he was sorry, but he couldn't help her at first. And this was while the plantation was being worked by slaves. Mm-hmm. So he refused to be involved. Later, after the war, when slavery was over, he did help her. He helped her with loans and so forth. And then later, she had to default to him. And he then bought the plantation, but with the proviso, she could live there the rest of her life. So it was an act of kindness. He did not enter the sugar business on purpose. That's how he got it started. And then he made a tremendously successful place that had been a disaster.
In my mind, I could see a tie in the way he sought out innovatively to use new things and do new things. So you got the Singer sewing machine, and then once he's in the sugar business accidentally, tell us all about Norbert Rilieu's patented sugar refining process and how this comes into play.
Well, I think you're absolutely right in assessing his character and his talent. It was not necessarily for inventing, but for adapting. And in the sugar business, it had been conducted in the same way for thousands of years. It was a very primitively run business right into the 19th century. And Leon Gotcho realized that this invention, which had not been used successfully, would transform the production of sugar at much lower cost, much less hazard to workers, which was important to him, moving hot molasses and sugar product by hand had been very dangerous, and fires had been caused and so forth. And he adapted this method And so he was an innovator wherever he went. And he was actually, as a young man, apparently very good at fixing machinery.
Oh.
He hadn't any training, but he could just tinker. He was interested in converting what was known to better purposes or good use. And he did the same thing with railroads.
All of a sudden, he has the capacity to refine sugar a lot more than he's actually producing.
Right. What he does is he's built these modern refineries, which nobody else had. And by the time he's been very inventive, he owns 10, 12, then 14 plantations finally. But he buys them in clusters very smartly around these refineries that he's developed so that they're all in proximity to one another. And he thinks, well, why haul cane by cart and donkey into the refinery? There are these things called railroads that have come into the South finally. They were late to come. And he orders miniature or three-quarter scale engines and cars from the Baldwin Company, which was making the big regular commercial railroads, and lays track in his fields. And so that the miniature, sort of miniature, railroads are now bringing product directly into the refinery. And then that allows him to eliminate the production in each of the plantations and centralize production in three major mills and factories. And the railroads bring the cane into those three factories. And again, it's a reintroduction of a piece of equipment that others had used and invented, but he turns it to great purpose and something he's working on.
And I loved that his steam engines were miniature.
They were miniatures, and really they became artifacts, sort of historic artifacts. And I write that one of them even ends up hauling people around Disneyland. Mr. Disney buys one of the railroad engines, recommissions it, and in the book I have over 70 illustrations. One of them that I really like is one of Leon Gatcho's engines at Disneyland hauling people around.
We've been speaking with Peter Wolfe, author of The Sugar King, a biography of New Orleans business titan, Leon Gatcho. Coming up next, our conversation continues as we discuss the death and legacy of Gatcho. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Blue Plate Mayonnaise, the beloved secret ingredient of Louisiana kitchens for over 90 years, made with just oil, vinegar, and egg yolks. Now Blue Plate is dressing up seafood feasts with a new creamy cocktail sauce. Enhanced with bold horseradish and a secret blend of spices, you just dip, savor, and say, ah. And for a touch of Creole charm, Blue Plate's Creole tartar sauce, complete with pickles, aromatic herbs, and a touch of Creole mustard, all together in that classic mayo base. Blue Plate mayonnaise, it's the good stuff. And from Louisiana Fish Fry, now doing for chicken what they've always done for fish. Fried chicken tenders, wings, sandwiches, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry has you covered with a mix specially for chicken. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. And from Visit the North Shore, discover world-class culinary flavors on the North Shore this spring. Experience the bounty of the bayou and rich culture from award-winning chefs, soulful mom-and-pop restaurants, extraordinary bakers, and creative mixologists. To learn more, request the Explore the North Shore Visitor Guide for inspirational stories, custom itineraries, and event information at visitthenorthshore.com. St. Tammany Parish, Louisiana's easy escape, just 40 minutes from New Orleans French Quarter. If you're just joining us, we've been discussing the life of Leon Godshaw, titan of the 19th century sugar industry in South Louisiana. His rags-to-riches story is chronicled in The Sugar King by Peter Wolfe, who just happens to be Godshaw's great-great-grandson. Godshaw helped modernize sugarcane production at his mill in Reserve, just 30 miles west of New Orleans on the Mississippi River. Tell us about that little town of Reserve and how it just became what it is today. It became a little town, really, because of the Godshaw sugar business.
It's true. They built schools and they built community centers and swimming pools and tennis courts, and they had movie houses, all sponsored by the Godshaw Sugar Company. And almost everybody in town at a certain point in time worked for Godshaw's. And you go there today, and nearly everybody in town still tells you about their uncle or their grandfather or even their father, who was part of the Godshaw group.
It left Reserve grocery store shelf ready, pretty much.
Exactly, huh? It did, in many different package forms, everything from a one-pound pack to a five-pound to a sack to the this and that. Sugar that was unprocessed, sugar that was brown sugar, powdered, every kind of sugar. It became a really big business. And by then, using cane imported from the Caribbean and exporting all around the country, they exported to 27 states. It was a gigantic sugar business, the fifth largest in the country at its height.
So, Peter, tell me what happens to it all.
Well, a lot and none of it very good. The sugar company is sold ultimately to the Zeckendorf, William Zeckendorf's interests. Their firm was called Webb and Knapp. It was sold under the market price in a kind of bad set of judgments made by family members and some others who were in management of the Godshaw sugar business at the time. And it's after that, after Zeckendorf gets hold of it, that parts of it, the operating business, is spun off to other sugar companies, and many people still probably remember Henderson Sugar and various names that were used for the operating business, but the Godshaw family had nothing to do with any of those. The land, which is what Mr. Zeckendorf really wanted, has been used for everything that you can imagine and that people who go up that way can see, from huge subdivisions to a globaplex port to all kinds of refineries.
And when was that?
It was in the 1950s, late 50s. 1956 is when the final deal was made with the Zeckendorfs, and then all the land development and all that occurred afterwards. The last really new innovative thing on that land was the Bell Point Dairy. They not only did the sugar business, but had a little bit of a dairy down there, too. That land became part of Bonacare Spillway. So I write about it kind of sadly, but I felt that I needed to report the way it occurred and what occurred. Otherwise, it would be lost in time and history. The store went bankrupt 30 years later.
Well, at least we do know, thanks to you, that your great-great-grandfather lived a long and wonderful life, and when he passed away, he wasn't sick for very long. Tell us about the end of his life.
Well, he was hearty. He was fine. He was vigorous. He was running simultaneously the sugar business, a huge international sugar business, and the store, the downtown commercial Godshaw's. His children were grown and educated. He really saw to their education. He cared so much about it, obviously feeling his own lack.
Peter, you must have developed such a closeness with your great-great-grandfather who you never knew. You must feel like you knew him, and he must be so visceral to you in so many ways.
It's true. I got that close, and that's a wonderful way to feel if you're writing about somebody, that you actually got to know them. It reminds me, I have a dear friend who was a very good biographer, a woman in New York, who wrote a biography of J.P. Morgan, and she said, "Peter, you know, I feel like I'm sleeping with Mr. Morgan." Well, that's kind of how I felt about Leon Gottschall.
Your great-great-grandfather tucks you in at night.
Yeah,
huh?
Sort of, yeah. And I think about characteristics that I have that he has and things that are different between us. You know, he's in my life.
Thank you, Peter. I enjoyed this conversation so much and have looked forward to it. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me onto your program.
Peter Wolfe is the author of The Sugar King, Leon Gottschall, a New Orleans legend, his Creole slave, and his Jewish roots. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where over a decade of Louisiana Eats is available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and cooking class videos, too. And don't forget to rate us on your preferred podcast platform. Meet and mingle with Louisiana's best chefs April 8th at the Lakefront Airport when the American Culinary Federation of New Orleans hosts their 10th anniversary gala. Emceed by Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser and Chef Kevin Belton, the evening includes a tasting menu prepared by both Louisiana's most well-seasoned and rising chefs, with entertainment from the Yat Pack. Proceeds support culinary scholarships for future culinarians. For tickets and more information, visit acfno.org. Louisiana Eats welcomes our new major sponsor, Blue Plate Mayonnaise. When your poor boys, potato salads, and remoulade need that authentic New Orleans flavor, Blue Plate Mayo, that's the good stuff. And big thanks to our returning flagship sponsor, Dickie Brennan and Company. Happy Hours back, Tuesday through Friday, 4 till 6 p.m. at the Black Duck Bar, upstairs at Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe on Canal Street. With live music, a new oyster bar featuring crudo and other cold seafood selections, and as always, the largest rum selection in the South. Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner Tuesday through Sunday weekly with jazz brunch on weekends. Louisiana Eats is also made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Crystal Hot Sauce, Rouse's Markets, Visit the North Shore, and Camellia Beans, celebrating their innovative new product, Beans for Two. Camellia's new red beans for two and white beans for two include everything needed to cook two authentically seasoned bowls of beans, scaled for today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. And from D'Agostino Pasta, celebrating our culture with fleur-de-lis, crawfish, and alligator-shaped pastas. All handcrafted in Louisiana, just as it's been done in Sicily for centuries. Visit D'AgostinoPasta.com to learn more. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner, producers Blake Longlinne and Steve Himmelfarb, with writing contributions from Becky Retz, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.